It's been said that genius and madness are neighbors, but just how close are they? Is there a link between creativity and mental conditions like depression, bipolarity, and schizophrenia? Nancy Andreasen, a psychiatrist and neuroscientist, has spent her career studying this question, and she writes about it in an article called Secrets of the Creative Brain in this month's issue of The Atlantic magazine. I'm very pleased to welcome her to our show. Welcome.
Nice to be here.
You begin the article in The Atlantic talking about your high-profile subject, starting with Kurt Vonnegut. What study was Kurt Vonnegut participating in?
I've done two studies of highly creative people. The first one was of people in the Iowa Writers' Workshop. And in that study, I studied 30 writers. Took me 15 years to recruit them because the style of the workshop is that there's a permanent faculty, and then each year about three guest faculty come in. And so Kurt was one of the guest faculty people that rotated through, and that's how I happened to study him.
And was it important that there had been a history of mental illness in his family?
No, not at all. I've written about how I began that study. I really did not anticipate I was going to have a high rate of mental illness in the writers.
What were you looking for in the study?
My working hypothesis was that they would have an increased rate of schizophrenia in their family members. And I thought that because I was interested in James Joyce, who had a daughter with schizophrenia and himself had some schizotypal traits. Bertrand Russell had a family full of schizophrenia. And for a variety of reasons, that was what I expected to find, that particular illness, and I expected to find it in the families, not in the writers. What I found instead was that the writers had a very high rate of what we now call mood disorder, depression, or bipolar disorder, and they also had that in their families, and very little schizophrenia. Creativity also ran in the families.
But not all great writers have had mental illness. What is the link here? Is this something that happens in some cases and not others? Or is there a certain kind of creativity that we can link to mental illness?
Well, for sure, not all great writers have had mental illness. That's a serious misconception and never one that I have presented. As I think about the link between mental illness and, let's just say, creativity in general, there is a kind of foundational personality and cognitive style that predisposes to creativity. And it's, being curious, risk-taking, adventuresome, exploratory, and that makes you more vulnerable to rejection and therefore to, let's just say, depression. But it also makes you more likely to be creative because you're, tracking out new pathways. So it's not, people often ask, does creativity cause mental illness? Does mental illness cause creativity? And my answer is it doesn't go in either direction.
And I remember many years ago, there was a debate among some artists about whether you should go into psychotherapy or not, because if you were cured, you might lose your ability to create.
Yes, I actually can remember that era when people talked about that. Of course, Woody Allen, one of the most creative people around, has spent years lying on a couch reassociating, and it hasn't done him any harm.
It's interesting that Kurt Vonnegut's son actually wrote two books about his own experiences with illness.
Yeah.
So there's mental illness in much of that family?
Yes. Kurt himself had depressions. Mark, the son, had, when he wrote the Eden Express, he had an illness that was diagnosed as schizophrenia, but he had been using drugs, and it may well have been a drug-induced psychosis. After that, he was able to go to Harvard Medical School and graduate and practice as a pediatrician, and did quite well until a fairly recent relapse. And for that, he was diagnosed apparently as having bipolar disorder.
Earlier in your career, you were not working as a psychiatrist. You admired Sylvia Plath as a writer. Did you identify with her? Did you want to write poetry like that?
I was never that good. I wish I were. She and I were near contemporaries, and our lives were on parallel tracks for a long time because we were both in literature. We went to Ivy League schools. We had Fulbrights to England. But as time passed, I also realized we were very different people. And as you know from reading the Atlantic article, I made the decision after 5 years of being an English professor to change fields and go into medicine. And in many ways, I think that really put me on a different psychological trajectory, because being able to, you know, actively do things to change the world for the better is really a very satisfying experience.
Why do you think when your book about John Donne was published that your reaction was not what you expected it to be?
Well, you know, again, I've talked about this a bit in the past. I had given birth to my first child and had developed puerperal sepsis and had to be rehospitalized, and I realized I would have died if I hadn't been treated with penicillin, or if penicillin hadn't existed. And so I finished up after that. The next summer, I finished up the book on Donne and sent it off to Princeton, which accepted it in a couple of months. I was, you know, in a state of disbelief. But I also said, you know, who's going to read this book? A bunch of Ivy League professors, literary scholars like me, and is it going to change anything?
Well, it would help you in your academic career, wouldn't it?
Yeah, but I really wasn't about advancing my academic career. I really was more interested in doing something that would help other people. And, I mean, that's what I realized, and that's what made a big difference for me.
The elation of getting a book published followed by the letdown afterwards, is that what led you to become depressed?
Well, I didn't say I became depressed. I didn't. I mean, I might have said I felt kind of depressed, but I wasn't clinically depressed. The reaction was simply, I did all this work, and who is it going to help? And I was also very, very young at the time, and I looked down the road and saw 40 years of teaching Shakespeare or other English courses to people who, undergraduates generally, are not that wildly enthusiastic about learning about, you know, English lit.
So you went to medical school, and
yes.
What kind of doctor did you think you would be when you entered?
Well, your friends, your physician friends always tell you don't make up your mind until you've had some clinical exposure. And so I went in with an open mind as much as I could. I had a close friend who was a radiologist who urged me to do that, and another who was a surgeon, another who was a cardiologist. But I really kind of got hooked on psychiatry when I did an elective rotation, a research rotation, after my sophomore year, and saw my first psychiatric patient who was psychotic with schizophrenia. And I just became fascinated with the question of how the human mind could produce such, you know, disturbed thinking.
Was this a person who had some genius?
No, this was just an ordinary person with schizophrenia. I mean, most people with serious mental illness are not highly creative. I mean, it is a true misconception that, having mental illness makes you creative.
But there are references to the connection between mental illness and genius that go all the way back to Aristotle and Shakespeare. So this is a notion that's not new.
No, of course not. The question is, first of all, is there really a relationship? The answer seems to be yes, because that's been documented in a series of scientific studies. Is there a relationship to a particular kind of mental illness? it seems as if the closest relationship documented so far is with mood disorders. Then the question is, how common is there a relation? How common does that relationship occur? And the answer to that varies, really, depending on the study, the people sampled, and so on. That's one of the reasons I'm doing this second study, where I'm looking at scientists and artists mixed together.
You say that one of the first people to examine the connections between genius and mental illness was Cesare Lombroso, an Italian physician. How long ago was that?
Well, that was back in the 19th century, and that book is really a comically terrible book. I mean, it shows the worst biases you can imagine people having. Biases against people who look funny, racial biases, biases against women. It's an interesting piece of history, but it's a terrible book.
Francis Galton, Darwin's cousin, took a more rigorous approach. How did he approach the study of genius?
He kind of carefully documented the extent to which genius ran in families. His book is called Hereditary Genius. If you actually read that Galton book, you see that he, too, had extreme prejudices. He blatantly says that blacks are inferior. He actually blatantly says that women are inferior. So, you know, some of these early works have significant flaws, I guess you would have to say.
My guest is Nancy Andreasen, who is a psychiatrist and neuroscientist. Her article, Secrets of the Creative Brain, is in this month's issue of The Atlantic magazine. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Nancy Andreasen, a psychiatrist and neuroscientist and author of an article called Secrets of the Creative Brain, which is in this month's issue of The Atlantic magazine. When did the debate over nature versus nurture arise?
Well, the first person to use that terminology to any extensive degree was actually Francis Galton, although in a book I've written, Shakespeare, in fact, used the term nature versus nurture in The Tempest when he had Prospero talking about Caliban. But
Shakespeare was first with everything, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Great psychologist.
Psychiatrist. I've actually written a paper on psychiatric diagnosis in Shakespeare's tragedies, The Artist as Scientist. He was actually masterful. I think he must have hung out around the local psychiatric hospitals of the era.
Who is Lewis M. Terman, and what was so remarkable about his genetic studies of genius?
Lewis Terman was a psychologist in the early 20th century and designed the first American IQ test called the Stanford-Binet test. He was also involved in helping design the Army Alpha test for World War I. He did a study that the first volume was called A Genetic Study of Genius, and what he did was recruit kids from California who had IQs of 135 or over, and then he followed them throughout their lives to determine what their long-term life course would be. I think he expected that these high IQ kids would go on and make great creative contributions, and the very striking finding is that they did not. They were reasonably successful and prosperous and a little bit healthier and happier than average people, but there were almost none of them that had major creative achievements. But I think Terman was very disappointed by that.
But shouldn't we assume that most of the most brilliant scientists and writers had high IQs?
Well, that's the assumption, but that wasn't Terman's finding. You know, his high IQ people did not go on to have great careers in either science or the arts. And so that study has pretty much led to what some people call the threshold theory, that you need to have a certain level of intelligence. Generally, people estimate about 120 to make creative contributions. But beyond that, it's other things than high IQ that make people creative.
And there have been attempts to create a quantitative assessment of creativity. Is that approach also controversial?
It's somewhat controversial.
What kinds of questions would be on those exams?
The idea behind those exams is that you can measure creativity by seeing how productively fluent people are when asked particular kinds of questions. That ability to be fluent and give a lot of responses is called divergent thinking. And so a typical question is, how many uses can you think of for a brick? And the person is supposed to come up with, well, you can throw it at somebody, you can build a wall, you can pave a street, you can grind it up and make a powder that you can use for paint. You know, there's all kinds of ways you could answer that. And then the answers get rated in terms of the number of responses and how original they are.
Do we even have an agreed-upon definition of creativity? Because standards change, don't they? Vermeer and Caravaggio weren't much respected for centuries. I can name you many, many great works of literature that got bad reviews when they were, Herman Melville, for example, Moby Dick, when they were first published. Is there any way to determine what is really creative and what isn't?
Not easily. You asked about a definition, and I think that the definition for which there's the most consensus is that something that is creative is novel or original, and it's also useful in some very broad sense. And I mean very broad, because obviously listening to beautiful music or producing beautiful music is creative. It's not conspicuously useful in the sense that a light bulb is, but it's, you know, elevates the human spirit. Things inventors do are creative, and so on. Some people have attempted to define creativity in terms of public recognition, and that has some advantages, but it also has serious disadvantages because, as you point out, people often are not valued in their own lifetimes. Van Gogh is an obvious example.
Bach?
Mendel from Sciences is an example.
Bach, for many years, was unappreciated until Mendelssohn brought him back. What approach did you take when you set out on your study?
Well, in each of the two studies I've done, the workshop study and then the one I'm currently doing, I decided that I would choose people that have what I would call face validity, or most people would look and say, yeah, Kurt Vonnegut was very creative. And so in the case of the workshop study, I had this sample that was right here in Iowa City, and I could just sit over the years and have people rotate through, and most people would say, well, workshop writers are clearly creative. The second study, I wanted to do scientists in addition to arts more broadly defined. And so I did set the standard that people have to have gotten some kind of public recognition.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
I do that knowing that that has certain flaws. There will be people who are very creative who don't get prizes, and some people who get prizes may not be extremely creative. But you have to start somewhere.
You use MRIs to study the changes in the brain produced by schizophrenia. Can we see anything about creativity by looking at an MRI?
The answer is yes. In this current study that I'm doing, I'm using a subtype of MR known as functional magnetic resonance imaging, where you basically give the brain challenges and you can visualize the activity occurring in the brain when it does different kinds of tasks. And this is a, you know, relatively new technique, and the results are, in fact, quite interesting.
You have to know where to look, don't you?
Well, you look at the whole brain. You don't, it's, in my mind, one of the most serious mistakes you can make if you're doing functional imaging is to think you know where to look. Because when we, I was one of the pioneers in this field, and when we started imaging people expecting to see memory in the hippocampus, and initially couldn't find any activity in the hippocampus. It's much trickier than you might predict just based on cognitive neuroscience or lesion methods or whatever.
You set up a PET scan study in 1995. What did the acronym REST that you used to describe it mean? And we have about 30 seconds.
Okay, random episodic silent thought, which it stimulates association cortex, and REST is a resource for creativity.
And have you, today, are you willing to say that there are direct links between creativity and mental illness?
You know, I have to say that mental illness does not cause creativity. Creativity does not lead to mental illness.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it there.
There is an association. Yeah, that's where it is.
And Nancy Andreasen's article, Secrets of the Creative Brain, is in the current issue of The Atlantic magazine. Thank you so much for being on our show today. It's been fascinating.
Well, thank you.